You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Things do not always fit together easily or neatly. And admit it, life would be pretty boring if they did. And that's the idea behind the podcast, Mismatch, now launching its second season. Mismatch is hosted by veteran Detroit newsman Roger Weber and produced by Zach Rosen, who's here now to talk about the first story of this new season, which we're all about to hear, called The House That Beards Built. Zach, going into season two of Mismatch is proof that you and Roger are onto something people like listening to.
Yeah, thanks. We hope that people are listening. And this season, what we wanted to do was focus a lot on history stories. It's a kind of emerging podcast genre that folks seem to be really into, where we, you know, look way back into some kind of unknown chapter and pull out some really interesting details from it. And that's what we did a lot with this particular season of Mismatch.
And this episode that we're about to hear is called The House That Beards Built, and it's actually about something that we've explored sometime in the past on Stateside, and that is the House of David religious colony near Benton Harbor. And I love that you call this one of the strangest Michigan rabbit holes I have ever gone down. Why is that?
It's a really kind of perplexing, contradictory story. And I mean, it's this religious colony that forms at the beginning of the 20th century, and it's a story I literally had never heard anything about. I hadn't heard of the House of David until I kind of happened upon it on the internet not long before reporting this story. But there's some cult elements, but then there's some like amazing American ingenuity elements, and there's baseball, and there's Americana, and it's kind of all this stuff commingling. There's some creepy, there's some odd. There's a lot going on in this one story, and so I thought that it would be a really fun one to spend some time with.
Yeah, kind of in a nutshell. I mean, my goodness, there's religion, there's sports, and there's a sex scandal.
Yes, that's true. It definitely has all of those things.
And I was surprised in listening to your report that there still is a surviving member of this group, of this colony.
Yeah, there's actually a handful left, some of whom have joined later. But there's a couple really old-timers. None of them were there from the beginning, obviously, because that would make them like 120. But yeah, there are a few remaining members who are holding on to this ideology, holding on to this way of life, but they're doing it, you know, very quietly. They used to live among dozens or several dozens or even hundreds, and now it's just kind of them living on these grand grounds in Benton Harbor, but living with just one or two other folks.
So, Zach, what most surprised you as you kind of discovered and produced this story?
I think it's just that this kind of anachronistic, kind of old-timey religious colony remains today in Benton Harbor. Just, you know, there are parts of Benton Harbor that have seen better days, but you just pull up on this one corner and there's this house. It's one of the biggest houses in Michigan, and it looks kind of untouched by time, and it's just kind of like time stopped in this one little pocket of Benton Harbor.
Well, it is a Michigan rabbit hole that is really worth hearing all about in this podcast episode from Mismatch, The House That Beards Built. Zach Rosen, reporter and producer of this fascinating episode, glad you're here to share it with us so we can all enjoy it together.
Hey, it's my honor. Thanks.
And again, this next story is about the House of David religious colony formed in Benton Harbor at the beginning of the 20th century. Zach recently caught wind of this infamous group and traveled to Benton Harbor to learn more about their strange and fascinating history.
Ron Taylor is busy.
Hello.
He's trying to tell me his life story, but he's got other people vying for his attention.
Uh-oh, this is my sister. Hello.
Ron has a long, shaggy gray beard. I can't tell exactly how long because he wears it tied up in a bun. And his hair is covered with a brown newsboy cap.
Last time I had a haircut was in 1971. I only shaved twice. I couldn't grow a beard to begin with. It wouldn't come through, so I only shaved like twice.
Ron lives on 54 acres of what was once a bustling religious colony in Benton Harbor.
Well, the theology is Christian. However, the roots are back to the Jewish idea. When you go back into the time of Christ and before, the Jewish nation looked for a Messiah that would recreate a kingdom on earth for Israel. That's what we believe.
To be a true House of David follower, you vow not to shave, drink alcohol, eat meat, or have sex. And since the colony forbade sex, even for procreation, Ron Taylor is one of the last members left. And you've had a number of jobs here. List them for me.
I help with concrete work. I do carpentry. I run the office. I do the mail service.
I do the paper monthly.
I'm cleaning an apartment right now. I do plumbing. I run the gardens up here at Shiloh.
I run the museum.
I'm the director of that. I created the archive. And I do roofs, repair work. I'm up on a roof quite often. You know? So, yeah, it goes on.
That's
and on.
It?
Yeah, well, that's
amazing.
All. Yeah.
If you chose not to have sex ever again, not to start a family, how would you want to spend the rest of your life? The Israelite House of David was founded by a married couple from Kentucky, Benjamin and Mary Purnell. But long before they established a religious colony on the west side of Michigan, they traveled the country, preaching. To make money, the Purnells made and sold brooms out of their horse-drawn wagon. An old black-and-white photo shows Benjamin with his then-teenage kids, Hetty and Roy. The kids are standing on the edge of the wagon, with the horses right in front of them. Hetty's holding a ukulele. Roy is holding the ropes attached to the horses. The wagon's roof has a little awning, there's a chimney, even windows. It's more like a trailer. Benjamin is standing on the ground next to the wagon. He's got a long, dark beard, straw hat. The Purnells' itinerant life took them through Kentucky, Indiana, Michigan, and Ohio. Benjamin preached at churches and on street corners, at religious meetings, and the homes of his benefactors. By 1902, the Purnells settled in Fostoria, Ohio, among a small group of followers who believed Benjamin was a messenger from God.
One of the final messiahs on earth before paradise was going to begin.
This is Chris Siriano. He's not a follower himself, but he's been studying this history for 30 years. He runs the House of David Museum in St. Joseph, Michigan, which is right next to Benton Harbor. He says back in the early 1900s, Benjamin's new followers totally supported him.
They gave him a ton of money to get started, to get a church down there, which he called the God House, and Fostoria loved him.
Once they settled into their new town and new church, their daughter Hetty got a job at a fireworks factory. And on her first day of work, Benjamin was giving the sermon at his church.
And he could point out the window of the church to show that where the location was, because it was a huge factory, and they could see it from the church. And during his sermon, the fireworks factory caught on fire and imploded. It was very obvious that there were probably no survivors.
To understand the Purnells' reaction to their daughter's death in the factory disaster, you have to know that their version of Christianity was influenced by the Nazarite tradition described in the Old Testament. Here's Ron Taylor again.
If you're a Nazarite, the Nazarite vow is not just cutting hair. There's many other things involved with it. One of the things is you cannot have anything to do with the dead. Okay? So if you're a Nazarite and your wife dies, your next of kin, your cousin, somebody dies, you can't partake of that. So going to a funeral or having to do with the dead was forbidden.
Not showing up to your daughter's funeral? It didn't sit well with some of the townspeople in Fostoria. And though Ron Taylor disputes this part of the story, House of David Museum founder Chris Siriano, he claims some of Fostoria's townspeople stoned the Purnells' church.
And he had already anticipated some resistance against himself for doing what he did. And so they escaped in their horse and carriages.
The Purnells ended up on the west side of Michigan. It was there where they met the Boschke brothers,
that had the second leading wagon factory in America behind Studebaker.
The Boshkis were also members of a church called the New and Latter House of Israel, and members of that church had been waiting for a prophet, someone they believed to be the seventh messenger of God. And that's who Benjamin claimed to be.
And then they rushed him up to Grand Rapids and introduced him as that to their congregation. They totally accepted him. They believed him. He was so intelligent with all those teachings and so well informed that he convinced them all.
Convinced them that if they stopped eating meat, drinking alcohol, having sex, and keeping their own money, they would live forever. Not spiritually speaking, actually. Benjamin promised everlasting life of the body for true believers.
And so immediately, that whole congregation turns over all their worldly possessions to him and Mary, including the Boshke brothers, who gave him over $400,000 in cash.
Plus, the Boshkes helped Benjamin and Mary buy a big piece of property in Benton Harbor, Michigan.
Gorgeous piece of property. Huge.
What did he have that they were so compelled by?
That's very, very confusing how so many super highly intelligent, super successful, wealthy people could be convinced to give all everything they had up for a promise of everlasting life. But I think there's a time in life that people get to where that stuff doesn't matter anymore and you're worried about mortality. And if you give all this up, I'll teach you how to live forever. And you'll never die. And you'll walk into 1,000 years of paradise on earth. Amazingly, he convinced thousands of that. And these were no dummies.
In 1903, on that sprawling property in Benton Harbor, Benjamin and Mary founded the Israelite House of David. Immediately, they started constructing these incredibly ornate buildings. The centerpiece of the property was the Shiloh Mansion, named after the walled city in ancient Israel.
This is a massive mansion made from cement blocks. It looks like it's been beautifully maintained. There's balconies, there's fountains in the front. It's really beautiful.
The Shiloh Mansion is on the National Register of Historic Places, and it's considered the biggest home in the state of Michigan, single-family type home, 32,000-plus square feet, 102 rooms. The style is high Victorian.
The property used to be open to the public for tours, but not anymore.
It's highly, highly gigantic, ornate woodwork over every doorway, over every window, a three-story, hugely ornate staircase.
Inside the Israelite House of David, marriages weren't recognized, and so husbands and wives who joined up together became brothers and sisters.
Men had certain wings of the house, and women lived in the other wings.
And so if you came there married as husband and wife, you became brother and sister, and then, but you wouldn't, like, would you remain partners?
You had to be separated from them physically. The only time that you could be with your spouse is if you wanted to eat breakfast, lunch, or dinner in the married couple dining hall. So it was entirely up to you whether you wanted to be with your spouse that you came with. You had 30 minutes that you could eat with them. That's it. Then you go back to doing whatever you needed to do.
Not only that, once you joined the colony, you had to sign over all your possessions and money to Benjamin. But despite the strict rules, word of the House of David spread fast. In 1903, Benjamin and Mary published what became one of their most famous religious texts, the Star of Bethlehem. And it became very popular. You can find it online if you're curious. The word of Benjamin made it all the way to a group of Christian Israelites in Melbourne, Australia. 85 of them arrived on the same day in 1905.
Amongst them were a husband and wife that owned a diamond mine, and a brother and sister and husband and wife that were like world famous actors and actresses, and on and on and on. They came from all over the world like that. And so he acquired all of their wealth, and he just turned it into gold. They say that Benjamin was unbelievable at figuring out talents of people, even if maybe they didn't know they had that kind of talent. He could work with somebody and say, you know what, you should be doing this. And so I'm going to build you a building, and I'm going to give you the help, the financial help, and the workers to help you make what you should be doing the best in the world.
One of the Australians was an instrument maker named Joseph Hannaford. When he arrived, he built up a successful business manufacturing violins, mandolins, guitars, and fiddles.
Whether you're an artist, whether you're a musician, whether you were a sculptor, whether you were a steam engineer, he would take your talent and make you succeed at your highest level, because there was no holds. There was no, you didn't have to worry about money. You didn't have to worry about, how am I going to afford to build a building? How am I going to pay the electric? How am I going to hire help? He did all that for you. You just had to do what you were good at.
How many members lived there at the peak?
There were just over 1,200 members there at the House of David property in Benton Harbor. There were over 4,000 members worldwide.
When I think of a religious colony, I think of a group of people insulating themselves from the rest of the world. But the House of David was just the opposite.
They had a huge amusement park and a zoo. They had the world's largest steam engine railroad ride at an amusement park. They made their own stringed instruments. They had their own recording studios. They had jazz bands and blues bands and orchestras and vaudeville shows and talent shows, and they were considered in the 1920s the best vaudeville show in America. They took it from just a religion to one of the biggest attended amusement parks in America back in the early days of Coney Island and before Disneyland.
And then in 1914, the House of David started a baseball team, and they were really good.
They wanted to play in the majors, and they were good enough to play in the majors, and they could beat a lot of major league teams. But back then, you had to be clean-shaven, and they weren't going to shave because they thought their whiskers were getting them to heaven.
More to come from the podcast Mismatch after the break. And we always want to hear from you. What stories are you focused on and issues that you want to hear more about? Let us know. Find us on Facebook by searching for Michigan Radio, and we're on Twitter at Stateside Radio and MichiganRadio.org. Just click the link that says Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and today we're bringing you a locally produced podcast called Mismatch. Before the break, you heard about the House of David religious colony from Benton Harbor. About 100 years ago, they formed a baseball team that was unparalleled in both skill and facial hair. But there is so much more to this strange story. Here's producer Zach Rosen.
How did it happen that these religious dudes happened to be brilliant baseball players?
Benjamin saw a bunch of guys that had joined. People joined from all over the world.
Chris Siriano runs the House of David Museum.
About 1912, I think, a Talley family came from Arkansas, and they had four brothers that were super athletes. And Benjamin noticed that they were good ball players, so he just decided to start a baseball team. By 1915, they won the championship of Michigan in this area. And by 1917, they're in the Spalding Baseball Digest, which is like the baseball Bible. And 1919, they're on the front page of the New York Times and the front page of the St. Louis papers. And, you know, they're getting invited all over the North American continent to play.
Ken Burns features them for a fleeting few minutes of his multi-part baseball documentary. There's an old black and white video of two bearded men playing catch. One of them catches the ball behind his back, then under his leg. The House of David ballplayers were basically the Harlem Globetrotters, years before the Globetrotters even existed.
And one of the guys would pick his chin up, and the ball would be hiding underneath his whiskers. And
was the baseball barnstorming partly motivated by spreading a way to spread their message?
They did have people that would distribute propaganda in the baseball stadiums. I don't think that's really the purpose of going out. I think it was a purpose of getting those guys with a lot of energy out there and having some fun, and they made a lot of money.
So much money, they were able to hire one of the best pitchers in Major League Baseball to be their manager, Grover Cleveland Alexander.
He was a funny guy, he was entertaining, and they didn't make him grow whiskers.
The House of David baseball team became a national sensation. Chris Siriano says they were good enough to play in the majors, but because they wouldn't shave their beards, they weren't allowed in. And so, instead, they barnstormed across the country, setting up their own games with local semi-pro teams.
They would show up early, and they would stand in front of the barber shops and wave their hair around and braid their whiskers and sign autographs and dance in the streets and just put on a huge show.
In addition to their biblical beards, the House of David was also responsible for showing baseball fans something else they hadn't seen before, an integrated game. Years before Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier in the major leagues, the House of David was traveling the country with African American teams. You've probably heard of Satchel Paige before. He was the star pitcher of the Kansas City Monarchs, and arguably the best pitcher of all time. Paige and his Monarchs played tons of games against the House of David. But usually, the House of David ball players were invited to play in towns that the African American players weren't welcome in. But the bearded boys from Benton Harbor had a plan. They would show up to games early and meet with the local team's managers.
And say, you know, hey, we're so excited. We're going to put on an amazing show for you. We're so excited that there's thousands of people here to welcome us and treated us well. And we'll do great for you guys. We'll make you proud. But here's the deal. Before you play us, you're going to play this black team that's sitting in our other bus right outside of your city limits. And after you play them, you're going to play us. And then after the game, we're going to eat in a restaurant together. And we rented rooms for all of us at the hotel tonight. And Mr. Baseball Manager, we know that these guys have never been allowed in your stadium before, but they're going to play today. And if you don't allow that, the next town right outside of your town is sitting on rain check. And they're excited that if we don't play you guys, we're going to play them. And so can you make that all happen, or should we just move on?
The story of the House of David seems too good to be true. Between the baseball team and the amusement park, the beautiful mansions, the warm relations the colony had with its neighbors, to its respected leader, Benjamin Purnell. So where do you come down on the cult question? Was House of David a cult?
That's a million-dollar question, and I often think that a cult is gives me bad vibes, and it was a bad thing in history, like David Koresh or Jim Jones were. The House of David was a great thing in history, and they were kind-hearted inventors and creators and welcoming America to be entertained. And so what's the definition of a cult? It was a twisted form of Christianity, I think. And if they were a cult, they were a good cult.
Be that as it may, the House of David was brought to its knees in the 1920s when Benjamin Purnell was accused of having sex with teenage girls from the colony. Rumors and accusations began piling up about how young women were taken from their sleep
to be whisked in darkness and brought over to Benjamin in his third floor ballroom with music playing on his phonograph, Victrola, and him sitting on the edge of the bed talking the word of God, and that he was basically the Son of God, kind of equal to Christ, and he had to do these things to them to save them, to plant the eternal seed of life in them, to purify their blood.
In 1927, the judge presiding over his case said, "In the minds of his people,
Benjamin has established a kingdom separated from the world in which he has held temporal and spiritual dominance, ordering the physical lives of the members and directing the aspirations of their souls and the operations of their minds. It was one of the most sensationalized trials of the 20th century.
1,600 pages of court documents and hundreds of people testifying both against and for him on both sides.
Here's a piece of testimony reported by the St. Joseph Herald Press in June of 1927. On the stand that day was 24-year-old Gladys Rubel. As an infant, Rubel was one of the original 85 Australians to migrate to Benton Harbor with her family.
How old were you at the time of this first visit to Benjamin's room?
I was 13 and a half years old.
Were you given any warnings when you left Benjamin?
Yes. He told me not to tell my mother, and not to put it in my written monthly confession, as there was nothing wrong with it.
Did you think there was anything wrong about it at the time?
No, I don't believe I did. I didn't think the Son of Man could sin.
Rubel went on to say that a confidant of Benjamin's, an older woman named Mary Ranger, was in charge of the colony's young girls.
When I came back to Mary Ranger after my visit to Benjamin's room and cried, she told me I should feel honored that the Son of Man had chosen me. She told me that was the only way I could get my blood cleansed and become immortal.
Benjamin Purnell theorized that his accusers were liars and after his money. He told a newspaper reporter at the time, "I have lived a stainless life ever since I received this most holy faith those 33 years ago, and the stories that I ruined those young girls under the guise of religious rites are total falsehoods. Money, the root of all evil, is behind this. It is blackmail, pure and simple, and I have learned that people will do anything for money."
In the end, he was acquitted of all the rape charges. He was found guilty of operating a religion under false pretenses for personal gain because he did live like a king and they could prove it.
But before Benjamin Purnell could be sentenced, he died of tuberculosis.
And because they thought that he was the Messiah and like Christ, they thought he was going to rise again, so they kept him damp, wrapped in damp, warm towels for 8 days. And finally, the Bering County coroner went in and said, "We're going to bury him, or you're going to bury him." And they had already sent away for the embalming technique that had embalmed the Russian emperor, Lenin. And so they embalmed him, embalmed his body, and they put him in a hermetically sealed glass coffin where they thought that he would rise up again and lead them into paradise on earth. And he's still there.
Where is that?
91 years later, in the Diamond House, in his mansion, on the second floor. Yeah, heavy duty. He still looks, he looks like he just died. They did an amazing job with his body of preserving him.
And we can't go in there, but you've seen him. What does he look like?
Just looks like an old man that just died. You know, he aged, the tuberculosis aged him a lot. It was rough on him.
Chris last saw the body in the glass coffin in 2004. He says Benjamin was laying there peacefully with his white hair and beard and gray suit. His writing desk remained in the room, along with photos on the wall. In 1927, after Benjamin died, there was mass pandemonium at the House of David.
So Mary knew what Benjamin was preaching more than anybody on the planet from 16 years old. And so naturally, she should have been the person that continued on at the House of David to bring in, continue bringing in new members and continue the story. But the guy that defended Benjamin during the giant trials of 1926-27, Judge Harry T. Dewhurst, and from California, at that time, Judge Dewhurst said, I'm the leader of the House of David now. I'm going to take over. The man is the head of this household. There's no woman that's going to be the head of this household. And so he went to war with Mary and actually went to trial against her, sued her for the leadership. And it went all the way to the Michigan Supreme Court, and he won. And so the court said, basically, Mary, you need to leave. You have to leave the property. And so she took with her a very small amount of cash and possessions. But she did take with her like 300 and some plus members, the very earliest people that had joined the colony when it was just her and Ben. Those people walked with her, and she started what she called the Israelite House of David as reorganized by Mary Purnell, which later became Mary's City of David and now today referred to as just the City of David. It was the exact same thing. She just went down the road 1,000 feet and across the road and started her own House of David.
Did they build it from scratch?
They built it from scratch.
All right, now I'm standing at the entrance to Mary's City of David. There's a Michigan Historic Site sign right at the entrance. It says, after the death of Benjamin Purnell in 1927, the Israelite House of David religious community split over spiritual direction and accumulation of assets. Purnell's wife, Mary, left and founded Mary's City of David on this adjacent site in 1930.
At the split, it became war. It became a brother would stay at the House of David and a sister would go at the City of David. There was major animosity between the two. They couldn't stand each other.
It's at Mary's City of David where I met Ron Taylor. His family sided with Mary after the split. Today, Ron is one of just two members remaining at Mary's City of David. He's 68 years old, so he wasn't even alive during Benjamin's trial. He actually grew up outside the faith, but his grandparents were members. They moved to Benton Harbor from Sydney, Australia in the early 1930s.
My dad was 3 years old when they joined. My dad decided that he believed it, but he met a wonderful woman, of course, and so left the colony, married, had the children. I'm sister and I, the surviving of three.
When Ron was in his 20s, he traveled around a lot. But then he came back to Benton Harbor in the 1970s.
And so I got a job working at the greenhouse here, and I was already studying religions of the world. I was fascinated with religion from a kid up, you know. So I had a good smattering of that wherever I went, Zen Center in San Francisco, and studied Hinduism. And there was a Jewish mystic that was part of a group in Detroit that I was part of. But when I started reading this, I thought, wow, this is really different. I really like this.
Did you have any reservations about taking a celibacy vow? Because you had lived a life without that, I would imagine.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I had girlfriends, and I was going to marry at one time and almost did. And we've remained friends. It was a real wonderful thing that we didn't marry. I just wanted something much more than that. And I thought joining a religious society, having a religious belief, was a step above that.
What does it feel like to be one of two remaining members?
Well, that's a good question. A lot of people wonder how I feel about that. I feel kind of blessed. I do. I knew as a child I was going to live a different life. Back when I joined, there were 56. I feel very at home, feel very comfortable, and I like what I'm doing, and I'm going to do it as long as God allows me to do it.
This is a naive question just because I don't know, but you believe in everlasting life. So how do you understand when you see all your brothers and sisters dying?
It's actually prophesied of that the time would come when the House of David would come down to so few that one would do the work of 10. Well, we've been there for a while.
Like Mary's City of David, the original Israelite House of David down the street only has a few members left. The two factions, divided only by a small stretch of pavement in Benton Harbor, Michigan, have put their grievances aside.
And in fact, when I was working at the greenhouse, before I was a member, the House of David people came over here and said, we're going to plant a whole field of potatoes in one of our vacant properties. We have everything but the potato digger, and that's what you have. If you'll help us harvest and help us maintain, you can get all the potatoes you want all year in our dugout. So the colonies worked together on the same potato field, and I went over there as part of the crew because I wanted to be part of that. I thought that was so cool. And today it's like it's basically we're both small, struggling to maintain and go on and keep up. And it's basically whenever one can help the other, we do. And that's just the way it is.
Zach, that is an amazing story. I have to wonder, though, what happens to the property when all the believers are gone?
Well, the original House of David has actually been embroiled in a lawsuit recently. The Detroit News named two guys who are relatively recent converts to the House of David, and they were sued as part of an alleged conspiracy to loot the organization of a bunch of money, $50 million. Those guys have not commented, but the suit was actually dismissed by an Oakland County judge recently. So the story continues. I'm not really sure what's going to happen.
That was an episode from the podcast Mismatch. To hear more stories, check out mismatchpodcast.com or search for Mismatch wherever you get your podcasts. And that's our show for today. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Our producers are Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Production and web assistance come from Joey Horan, Bella Isaacs, Sarah Leeson, Katie Raymond, and Jody Westrick. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.